Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Game of Thrones podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. Also, George Martin's new Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, and continue to be the officially official place to discuss Gods of Thrones, our new book that's out. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
Speaking of my other co-author. And yeah, we're here to talk about the first section of the Fire and Blood book. And we read all the way up to the chapter Jaehaerys and Allison, Their Triumphs and Tragedies. That's roughly the first third of the book. Next week, we're going to be covering all the way up to the Dying of the Dragons, Rhaenyra Triumphant, and then from there, we will be finishing the book. So Anthony and I have done that, and we've written down some things that jumped out at us as things that were important or things that might be interesting to talk about, and we'll be getting to that in a moment, but I want to talk a little bit about Gods of Thrones business. First of all, we've been setting a goal to get 50 reviews because we thought that was key to kind of our, like, you know, marketing cornerstone. We get that early buzz going. It would help us out. And we just crested the 50 mark early this week. And I wanted to read David's review. He was one of the ones. It's hard to say which one is the 50th review, but he was pretty close to it. 5-star review. Bought it for the Clegane Bowl artwork, he says. And what do you know? There's a book that goes along with it. In all seriousness, I really enjoyed Gods of Thrones. It's an interesting dive into the religions of Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire world, and explains where the real-world inspiration that George R.R. Martin borrowed tenets and ideas for his religions from. While this may sound to you like a boring slog of a read, the authors inject lots of humor and pop culture references, as well as some interesting fan theories that have reared its head on these here internets. Also, kudos to Chase Stone for an amazing rendering of the Clegane Bowl. Thank you for that very nice review, David. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, David. I appreciate that. I also appreciated that David had the verified purchase category checked.
Yes.
I've learned that verified purchase reviews help our algorithm just so much more.
They carry more weight.
They do, yeah.
Because Bezos knows that you've been naughty or nice. He knows that you've bought Gods of Thrones, and now you've taken the time to review it, and that's all right by us.
And Chase Stone, our artist, definitely deserves a shout-out, and I appreciated that.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you think it'd be interesting? Because I thought about asking him if he wouldn't, you know, like if he'd give like a 10 or 15-minute interview about his art and his process and working on the book. Do you think people would be interested in that?
I would listen to that.
I guess I'm asking.
He seems like a really talented but also well-spoken fellow.
Yeah, I was thinking about asking see what the podcast audience thinks of that. And then I suppose I should ask him first before I get a campaign to bring him on the pod. But yeah, we appreciate that. Also, people have been asking me this last week about when the paperback version is coming out. It's out. There's a link in every one of the show notes of this year podcast series that has a link to our Gods of Thrones book. And Amazon finally got them all merged together today. So like the paperback and ebook now have the same landing page, and it's much easier to find, you know, if you want whatever version, you just click on the other. If you're on the Kindle version and you want the paperback, you click other versions and voila. And also merged all our reviews together, which is nice. And the other thing I noticed, because we last week we did a Black Friday sale through Digital Monday, because, you know, that's what all the kids are doing nowadays. And Anthony and I didn't want to be left out. So we dropped the price of the book by 20%. And I noticed after I raised the price back up that it was actually less than we had discounted it. It's like almost 25% off. So I wrote Amazon, like, you know, what did I do something wrong? And I guess Amazon reserves the right to put your book on sale anytime they want. And the cool thing, so they've selected our book for some kind of ad campaign. And I noticed that they're also like giving there's a buy it together version where you can buy Gods of Thrones and Fire and Blood and get a discount. And then today, did you see this? They put us in with Fire and Blood, our book, and some book by Michelle Obama.
Yeah, Michelle Obama's number one bestseller, Becoming, is frequently bought together with Gods of Thrones and Fire and Blood. So yeah. On behalf of Michelle Obama, we thank you for that collective purchase.
Yeah, and I really liked her chapter about the rampant sexism of the maesters of Old Town. and any decent queen wouldn't stand for that. So she's definitely on hashtag Team Allison there. We'll get to that here in a bit, but I just want to let everybody know that it's I don't know how long the sale will last, but it's the lowest price that you'll ever be able to get it for the near future. If you go and buy it right now, because any moment Jeff Bezos could change his mind and the price goes back up. So you can get it for 25% off right now. That may change by the time it's airing, but you definitely should get it. I think it's time for us to just move on to our thoughts on Fire and Blood. I'd only read about 87 pages last week. I've now read up to 230 pages, the first third of it. I am actually surprised at how readable it is. I was kind of expecting it to be, drier, and I guess a lot of the stuff that was about Aegon, the Conqueror, was a little dry because I felt like I'm very familiar with that history. But when we start moving into the second and third generation of Targaryen kings, where, you might have only had a couple of paragraphs here or there in different Wikipedia articles or, Wiki Vice and Fire articles, I started getting a little bit more engrossed. What did you think of this first third?
I was a little bit worried because I heard an interview with George recently where he said, yeah, well, of course he's making this up as he goes along, but he said, when I originally wrote down the reigns of these kings, some of them had, remarkably short reigns, which means there's lots of fire and lots of blood, right? Because there's uprisings and usurpers and yada, yada, yada. But so Jaehaerys, he reigns for 50 years, and he's a pretty good king, which means... Mm-hmm. Oh, this is going to be, peace is really boring, So what he said in the interview was, so I decided I was going to have to sort of fill this out with, some intrigue. And like we were talking about before, it gets really gossipy and there's some lurid sex rumors and, there's lots of talk about weddings and who's not invited to the weddings. So I was a little bit worried about it being a little bit too, too boring. But I mean, I'm engrossed. This is really fascinating stuff. And sometimes, you go through a few pages and you're thinking, yeah, I don't really care about any of this. And then you get to that fourth page and you realize, yeah, that's why I come. That's why I come to George for political intrigue. Yeah, so I'm enjoying it.
There is a lot more political intrigue than I thought. Like, the first 2 years of Jaehaerys's reign, who's known as this good old king who reigned for 50 years, was already packed. Because I thought, it's funny because you say gossip. Like, I do describe this book as surprisingly gossipy and kind of bitchy in a TMZ kind of way. Where the maester will just go on for pages about these rumors and, well, maybe it's this and maybe it's that. And I'll cite particulars going forward. But I thought that's kind of some of it's a little eye rolly, but a lot of it was really interesting, especially it really makes Jaehaerys out to be very clever from a young age, navigating these political waters and heading off rivals and winning them over as allies and cutting the knees diplomatically out from underneath some of the more extreme religious elements that might have wished a Targaryen's harm. And that's why I read Game of Thrones, right? And some of the fake politics here are just really, really interesting. I did think that there's a couple points that almost broke me, right around the was it the Golden Wedding where the Hand of the King married the old Dowager Queen, the mother of Jaehaerys, and they talked about the guest list, and it reminded me of back when I was reading the Bible. And you get the numbers, and it's Sodom begat Gomorrah, who begat Bethlehem, who begat Bathsheba, and it's just all these begats, and it's like, oh my God, why do I need to read the birth records of these damn Israelis, That is there like a page and a half of all the different people, of great lords and ladies who were invited, and whew. The other thing, it's very hard for me to keep a lot of these Targaryens separated. In my head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they all have bizarre spellings of like Allison. Can't just be spelled Allison. It's got to have an improbable amount of like Y's and N's shoved in there. And they're all very H and Y-y, and those kind of like, with me being a little dyslexic, kind of run together. So and they also, like, my God, we're only 3 generations of Targaryens. I think there's been 17 Aegons already.
Right. And it makes sense. I mean, it's like, I don't know. I mean, if there is a beloved a character, whether that person is a great actor or, mm-hmm. you know, a great war hero, you know, you do. Like, you in certain moments of history, you're going to see a ton of kids named after that person.
Oh, sure. I mean, they got up to how many? 8 Henrys, right? So it's you know, if John is and ends up being an Aegon, he'll be the 6th one. It makes sense. It makes sense. It's just very hard. It's just very hard when you're trying to keep them all straight. Lots of you know, you also see other names, like, you know, Joffrey pop up. There was someone on our forum saying that every time he sees the name Joffrey, like, his butt puckers up a little bit. So far, all the Joffreys have been pretty stand-up dudes. Like, yeah. I've come across 2 of them, and they haven't been like major characters, but, you know, they haven't murdered any babies or put any blood curses on anyone.
Yeah, I would imagine before 1930, there was tons of Adolfs running around Germany, and that was it was a fine name. You could be named Adolf. Yeah. It was not a problem at that point. Yeah.
Just destroyed a fine fine piece of facial hair too. Honestly,
you know, I was. What struck me was how important that link between the Targaryens and the Baratheons were.
Oh, right. Like, yeah.
From the very beginning, Hand of the King, and then, you know, you have the older queen, Mary, a Baratheon, and they're just really tight. It's a really important alliance, even from the early days, and it kind of sheds new light on the usurper and the Robert's Rebellion and whatnot in the novels.
Yeah, no, I remember, like, it's always been said that the Baratheons were kind of, like, distant relations to the Targaryens, and, you know, that Robert had the best claim to the throne because his great aunt, I think, was a Targaryen.
Right.
But they reveal in this book that the first kind of this, the Orys Baratheon, was the bastard half-brother of Aegon the Conqueror. Not only were they best friends, but they were half-brothers, too. So they have a very real blood relation as well. So I thought that is interesting that George kind of made that official anyway. So I guess we can just kind of trade interesting points if you want. That was one, so I'll go next. I thought it was interesting because you can tell that George really wants to make Maegor a bad guy. You know, he's called the Cruel, and anytime that George wants to bang a point, he always goes, in my mind, for too much. Like, there's 2 separate instances of Maegor conducting 6 years worth of trials and executions over these various rebellions and holy wars. And it's funny because he never indulges it, because you also can tell that George really, really wants to talk more about the torture and stuff. But he, you know, the Septon is strangely squeamish sometimes and strangely not squeamish other times. But that, you know, that made sure that Maegor, like, you know, he even though there's other important things to do in the realm, he stayed for all 6 months of mock trials and executing these people in ever more creative ways. Like, you know, this guy ruled for 6 years. He spent 1/6 of it torturing and executing people.
Right.
So that was really interesting, I thought. And also, just to kind of frame him as the Antichrist of the Targaryens so far, Maegor, who is one of the sons of Aegon. Just for people that haven't read the book yet, Maegor was the younger brother of the Aenys guy that we're talking about, or Aenys, the audiobook
gotta,
says it.
No, it's got to be Aenys, man. That's his name.
He's the younger brother of Aenys.
From now on, that's his name.
But he supplanted anus for obvious reasons. You can't be taken seriously with a name like that. And he took over the guy, but his reign lasted exactly 6 years and 66 days. Which,
right, so we've got
really pricks the Judeo-Christian
here,
Europe.
Shades here of Nero or Caligula, you know, one of these Roman tyrants that are really hated by the common folk and kind of known for their, you know, their extremely, you know, extreme behavior, in this case, extreme violence. Mm-hmm. And famously, the, you know, the book of Revelation in the New Testament is written as political propaganda and probably as a protest against Nero. And I think that there's probably a nod there to Nero in that 666 reference.
I thought it was interesting because it's a naked Mark of the Wild Beast reference, but he doesn't, you know, the maester doesn't belabor the point. He's just citing a historical fact, but they don't make it like, oh, that became the number six became right. a fated omen. I kind of was expecting that to kind of punctuate it, but it's just, nope, it lasted exactly 6 years and 66 days.
Right. And of course, this is a universe that, of course, famously, a seven is an important number, just like the kind of the biblical narrative as well. So
yeah,
we have a little bit of numerology that George likes to play with.
Yeah, but it's like he left on the table because the maester could have just observed that, you know, his reign fell short of the, you know, divine mark of perfection of it's like 7 years and 77 days right. would be the best. Let's back to you. Let's see what you thought was interesting.
I was really interested in learning a little bit about the doctrine of the seven, because I had to note in our chapter in chapter four in volume one of Gods of Thrones, which deals with the faith of the seven, that we learn a lot about the religion. I include like 45 facts because we learn a lot about sort of the practice, but we don't know anything about the doctrine. We know that they've got this sacred text, the seven-pointed star. Mm-hmm. But other than the fact that they don't go in for incest, what do these people believe? Like, why is this important? Not to say that there aren't religions that are not as doctrinaire, but if this is based on medieval Catholicism, like George says, we would expect some points of doctrine. So I was interested to find out that there was this new doctrine promoted by, help me out here, who was the king that promoted this?
This was the one that
Jaharis. Yeah, Jaharis. So Jaharis, he knows that he's not going to be accepted because he's married his sister. Because
his father, who was Anus, one of the many political missteps he made, other than having the name of Anus, was marrying his sister, which was kind of shocking that when the faith turned against this, because apparently it's like, you're like, well, you know, Aegon, whatever, and his dragons, but this weaker king, they weren't going to have it.
That decision throws the kingdom into war again. And so when Jaharis decides that he's going to marry, he's going to do it in secret because he's young and he's not ready to reveal it. But when he does reveal it, what he decides to do, shrewdly, he comes up with this group called the Seven Speakers. And what these are supposed to do is these seven speakers are supposed to go throughout the land and they're supposed to preach. And some of them are like, you know, miracle workers and healers and whatnot. But they're supposed to preach about how great the king and queen are and get the small folk on their side. Well, this turns into something called the doctrine of exceptionalism. And what this basically says is, hey, incest is not supported by the gods, and no one in the Seven Kingdoms should go in for brothers and sisters getting married. But we know that Targaryens are different, and they look different, and they ride dragons, and they are exceptional beings on the earth, and so that there are different laws that apply to them, the ruling class, and one of the exceptions to the rules that we find in the seven-pointed star is that Targaryens can marry brother and sister. So finally, we have this doctrine, explicitly, drawn out, and we've got like disputes about it. You know, we've got this argument between two folks, and one of them says, one of them asks the Septon, "Well, so can I go and marry my sister?" And the Septon replies, "Yeah, sure. Go tame a dragon and fly it around, and I will myself marry you and your sister."
Right. And he also had the line of argument that, like, look, the one god, the seven unified gods made us all, Andals and Valyrians and First Men, but they didn't make us all the same. He made the lion and the aurochs too, but it's not fair to make the lion live by the aurochs' rules and the aurochs live by the lion. It's not fair to either of them. So Targaryens are kind of like that. They're the lion and they're their aurochs, and they can be trusted with incest and we can't. It's actually, I thought, a fairly, clever argument as far as these things go.
Okay, so two thoughts on this. One is that this is kind of how doctrines emerge. We have doctrines. Like, why are Christians so invested in the idea that Jesus is co-equal with God?
You got me, Anthony, because as a Jehovah's Witness, I was always an Arian heretic.
Right, of course.
And rejected the divinity of the Christ.
Right. So aside from the heretics, a lot of Christians, most Christians, are really committed to this idea that Jesus is co-equal with God. Well, why is that? Mm-hmm. Well, because there was this massive controversy in the third and fourth century about whether or not, now this is like splitting hairs, but whether or not Jesus was equal with God after he was created, or whether he was present with God before creation. And that was the major dispute. And that, man, a lot of arguments, a lot of people were exiled and killed over that particular issue. And of course, that's how the doctrine emerges. Now, Christians long before that, even in the early, mid first century, believed that Jesus was divine in some sense, but it was very open to dispute about what actually that means. And it wasn't until these later disputes that we actually get this sort of definitive doctrine. And I think George plays this up really well. And the other thing I was interested in to ask you about, Aaron, because you're Mr. Libertine. So, one of my favorite movies is The Royal Tenenbaums.
Okay.
And in this movie, you have this really dysfunctional but really hilarious family. And I don't want to spoil this for anyone, but at one point, because if you haven't seen it, you absolutely should. It's a wonderful movie.
It's also but over a 15-year-old movie, so
it is. On, you're right. Chop, you're right. Chop. So basically, it turns out that this adopted sister and her brother are attracted to one another, and the father says, that's illegal. And the son says, well, we're not related by blood. And then Royal Tenenbaum says, it's still frowned upon, though, right? Even at that moment, I was feeling like, ooh, this is a little icky. I mean, even if a brother and sister are related only by adoption, it feels gross to me.
Right.
So here's my question. When do you think we're going to see the first brother and sister marriage as a result of George's influence, massive influence on Western culture?
Boy, I mean, I hope that's a bright white line we don't cross because...
Why? Tell me why. I'm curious to know why...
I mean, we're talking about literal brother and sister, flesh and blood brother and sister. I mean, it just seems like that's
I'm talking Targaryen brother and sister. Yeah.
I mean, I just think that I think there's a good sound biological reason to outlaw brothers and sisters getting married. And that is, there's lots of evidence that that inbreeding leads to bad outcomes for the children. So it, yeah. it'd almost be like a case of child abuse, like, you know, preemptive child abuse or neglect.
I agree. And I absolutely agree with you on this point. Keep going.
I will say that as a secular humanist, I find it very hard to say that, like, adoptive brothers and sisters couldn't marry each other. Because it's literally just a biological reason, you know, that the taboo against incest isn't just like a squeamish thing of humans. It's something that's like kind of innate to us. And also, the other thing is, I'd say it's weird. And depending, like, I would ask that, like, did they get introduced to each other late in life? Because there's also a biological thing that says that if you are socialized with people from like the age of 3 and under, that kind of inoculates you from finding them sexually attractive. And it works in any direction. Like if I'm a 12-year-old a boy and there's a newborn baby infant in the family, and then she grows up to be a beautiful woman, I won't see that and be sexually attracted to it because I knew her as a child. And it's the same thing to kind of, and then it doesn't work in all cases, obviously, because there's all kinds of incest and terrible tales of abuse.
Right.
But it does seem like there's also like an evolutionary safeguard there, that like if you come up in the same nuclear family or even in the same kind of tribe, which used to be before, you know, cities and states used to be kind of like loose couplings of very interrelated families, that there's kind of an inborn that's bad, and we evolve that to keep us from, you know, inbreeding into disaster. So that's
what
I would say.
Okay. All right. Well, I think.
Are you going to say, what if the brother and sister agree to be sterilized? Because then
I was
I'm
just
like, well,
going to say that. I was just going to say that.
I'm back. Well, that's gross, but.
See, that's my issue. All right. So let's say that I want to sort of fall back on evolutionary or biologically, this is dangerous.
Yeah, it's a bad idea beyond.
It's
just
a bad idea.
Ethics.
Okay, yeah. Right. But if I'm going to be honest with you, that's not why I don't like it. I don't like it because it makes me feel icky. Because
your evolutionary imperative.
Let's say if the brother and sister say, okay, well, we don't plan to have children. There's no reason to have children. We're not going to have children. So do you still oppose this? Do you still uphold the taboo? I'm going to say, yeah, it still feels gross. It's not just about the children thing. It just feels gross to me. And moreover, I'm not arguing for this. I'm just having a hypothetical conversation. But I used to feel icky about same-sex marriage. And I no longer do, but that should teach me, I think.
See, I was about
that
to come
everything
back.
I feel icky about, everything yep. I feel icky about is not a mandate for ethics.
Yeah, no, I share that particular shame that, and it's like I was about to say that, like, my 42 years on this planet have taught me to really be cautious about that reactionary streak when I think, oh, something gross I shouldn't. I don't understand it. It's weird. It's strange. Like, that's not a great reason to deny people the freedom to do whatever they want to do. So, like I'm saying, like, if I was president of the world and brothers and sisters that really loved each other and wanted to forego having children, I guess I would say that I can't think of a good reason why you can't. Because I think, you know, any kind of good rule or governance should have a good reason. You can't you can't tell your subjects, well, just because I said. And so, yeah, I would have to, yeah,
well,
but that's the thing. It's like,
I applaud you, Aaron. I applaud you for being consistent in your libertine ideology. I have to be honest. I'm going to be the fuddy-duddy on this one. I've got good reason besides the fact that it just makes me feel gross.
Yeah, I don't like, because this is something I've talked about in podcasts, if we want to take a complete digression, is I am a little uncomfortable with how much incest there's been in fiction of late. And how much I see that as kind of being like really fetishized online, because, you know, it's one of those things where it does, like, you know, practically in the real world, incest is almost always bad. It's almost always a form of abuse. And honestly, I don't know if we need to give all the Randy uncles and stepfathers and weird ants in the world any fuel for that fire. Because, and I'm like, it's also weird. It's like, maybe this is because the society itself has become more libertine, as you say, but like, it just feels like it's everywhere now. Like every damn HBO show comes out involves some kind of, you know, incest plot line. Like it's like almost a it's almost like a bingo checklist that you're doing for for prestige dramas nowadays. And I don't know. I do think that George is kind of all about it, though.
Well, it's all over the place with George's.
Yeah. But I mean, it's also all throughout history too, right? So it's hard to say that he's, you know, yeah,
that's one of the things that we talk about in volume two coming in April. Mm-hmm. That this isn't just part of George's sort of sick imagination.
Right.
This is part of human history. We have royalty, like the Egyptians.
Keeping bloodlines pure.
That's right. And and not only that, but there was a lot of gods that were believed to marry brother to sister.
Right.
Of course, these gods were not paragons of virtue in all cases. So, but here's the other thing I thought was interesting about the seven speakers. Is that I think that there may be an echo here to the founding of the Church of England. So in the 1500s, we're looking at the Reformation happening, and that happens for a number of reasons. But at about the same time, Henry VIII is king in England. And this is a very long, complicated story, but one very popular sort of summary of the story is that Henry VIII wants to divorce Catherine. Because she's not giving him an heir. He wants to marry Anne Boleyn. And prior to this problem in his life, he's dead set against the Reformation. He's condemning Martin Luther's protests in Germany. Mm-hmm. But he realizes, if I want to divorce my wife, the papal authority is not going to let me do it. So he ends up embracing, not just embracing sort of the tenets of the Reformation. He sets himself up as the head of the church in England. Mm. Now, this is interesting to me because you have this key religious shift happening around the Tudor period. And we know that George is really interested in the Tudor period. And sort of parallel to this, we can see at some point in Westerosi history, there was this key shift in doctrine, the doctrine of exceptionalism, that is basically motivated by Jaharis's desire to change the ethics related to marriage in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually thought – I almost said that, but then I'm like, I'm going to go – because I thought that, the Henry VIII example was a much more direct comparison to this Targaryen exceptionalism, that like this is an official church doctrine that's being changed, not because the gods whispered in any pontiff's ear or any septon's ear, but because the political will really, really, really wanted it. And I even wrote that I highlighted this one passage kind of illustrate the politics of selecting this high septon, that, you know, King Jaehaerys and his wife, Alison, rode their dragons out to Old Town to kind of like preside over the selection of the new high septon, because they knew it's absolutely crucial to get one that would be amenable to accepting this doctrine. Mm-hmm. And people are like, well, what are you throwing your dragon weight around? They're like, oh, no, we're just remaining in Old Town to get the new septon's blessing. Yeah, that's the ticket. That's the ticket. We just want the new septon's blessing. And as soon as this new septon is, and we'll hightail it out of here, we're not throwing our dragon muscle around. And just how deaf, and there's this passage where it's like, the lords considered, the maesters nodded approvingly, and the septons pondered or thought about dragons. You know, kind of like the cement. And to me, it's like a lot of this first third, I thought it's interesting to see how nakedly political and secular and vulgar it all is. And I'm like, wow, George is really kind of putting his thumb on the scales of the Faith of the Seven's a bunch of crap. But right. There's also like, you, and I'm like, how, almost to the point where like, how can the faithful just roll with these punches? But then he's very clever, and that the kings that thumb their nose at the Seven in various ways tend to have bad things happen to them. And you could argue from a medieval standpoint that there is a little cause and effect here, that like the father's not gonna smote the realm with fire, but he might make sure all your children die. And he might make your dragon get a weird hitch and throw you in battle or something. And I wonder if there's a little bit of that, you know, like that it seems like so manifestly fake, but then you get another month, a couple months ahead of the story, and then bad things are happening to these people.
Yeah, it's kind of like, did Melisandre basically... how responsible was Melisandre for the death of the people that she claimed to
oh yeah, the other usurper kings, right? Yeah,
yeah. So it's like, very, I think, debatable. George will sort of put that in sort of very murky light,
yeah,
so that you're thinking, yeah I could see how she might have influenced that. Or it could just be this odd Rube Goldberg device of causality that, yeah, maybe she was the motivator, maybe she wasn't, you know.
Yeah. There's something I want to talk about. Rhaena Targaryen, who is the brother of Jaehaerys, and there was some, because of the messy rule of Maegor, where he essentially usurped the throne from his brother. And also, I highlighted and triple underlined, there's this passage he has early in the book where people are trying to talk to him about, you know, lines of succession and how the law is clear. And Maegor says, the Iron Throne will go to the man who has the strength to seize it. And I'm going to remember that because like, people love to ask about who's got the strongest claim for the end of the Game of Thrones. And it's like, man, if you've watched this show to this point and don't realize that all that stuff is words and words are wind, then I don't know what to tell you, because Aegon didn't have right to shit. He took it. Maegor certainly didn't have right to shit. He took it. Jaehaerys had a divided claim between him and his sister, and they just kind of decided it because, well, Jaehaerys is the one on the throne, and he had one more dragon than her.
And also, Jaehaerys could have easily been dethroned if he wasn't smart. I mean, he set up this situation where he knew that his father-in-law and mother were going to try to separate him and his sister.
Right.
And he just outsmarted them. You can, you know, if you can have a political or genealogical right of succession, that's great. But if you don't know how to make that work for you, either by strength or by wit, then you're not going to keep it for very long.
Right. And so anyway, this Rhaena Targaryen lives in kind of semi-exile on Dragonstone. So she takes her dragons and her children, and she takes them to Dragonstone. And the book is very clear about how the dragons just got busy on Dragonstone. Like, all the eggs that hadn't hatched, that they brought there, had now suddenly hatched. There's baby dragons being born all the time. Some dragons escaped, and they were in the wild part of Dragonstone, like beyond the other side of the mountain, and they were breeding. Like, these dragons are just so prolific. And there's a parallel story here where Jaehaerys is finishing the last brick of the Great Dragon Pits. And in fact, we close at this section of the book, the first third of it, with the Dragon Pit just being completed. And we know that once the Targaryens move the dragons into the Dragon Pit, that begins the decline of their line. Because up to this point, the dragons are getting bigger and stronger. Like, this line of Dreamfire especially seems to be like primed to make these legendary dragons that give Balerion the Black Dread a run for his money. And then they all just kind of they go in decline. And I'm really curious, because, you know, it's been a long held fan theory that the Maesters kind of had a hand in the decline of the dragons, because they were these things that just really upended the power balance in Westeros, and convincing the Targaryens that they needed to have this big stable that was worthy of their steeds could have been the thing that, you know, undoes them. It seems like it might be made explicit in this book, because why else have the story of the dragons being unusually prolific on Dragonstone and breeding almost uncontrollably, to the fact that they're getting loose and escaping, and then they're brought to the dragon pit, and they just start getting shrimpy and stunted and.
Right. So I keep waiting to see clues like that to think, okay, so is it true that the dragons diminish in captivity? Because that's kind of the official narrative, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The counter narrative to that is to say that, no, that's all propaganda. Someone was poisoning or doing something to kill off the dragons,
right?
And because, of course, if you can denuclearize another country, then you
why not do it?
Yeah, why not do it? So so I keep looking for clues to that. Now, that was also, I think, the portion of the book where, correct me if I'm wrong, there's a reference to three lost dragon eggs.
Yes, so the same Rhaena Targaryen, who's living in semi-exile, has taken, I think if I'm reading between the lines, this lady Elisa Farman was her lover.
Yes. No, that's
at
right.
At all accounts, a close associate, and she, you know, got tired of being cooped up on Dragonstone the whole time, and she wanted to go explore the sea. She's got a Moana complex, and she steals three of these unhatched eggs and makes off to Braavos, where she sells them to a Braavosi sea lord.
So I think that the obvious connection that George wants us to draw is that these are the three eggs that eventually make their way into Illyrio's possession and given to Dany as gifts, that eventually become the three dragons in the novel.
I guess the only question is why is George, like, that's a mystery that I never really needed an explanation. Like, it's like, he's really obsessed with balancing the egg count here. Do you have any ideas about, I have one kind of idea.
Okay. All right. So I saw this interview with John Hodgman, and you can see it on YouTube. And John, it's you know, it's a lot of George's sort of greatest hits when he's interviewed. Uh-huh. But what Hodgman leads off with is he says, "Look, late in the book, there's a reference to an elephant coming to Westeros, but we never hear of the elephant again. So it's really obscure." And what George says is, "Well, at one point in the books, I said that Balerion's head was bigger than an elephant, and I thought, how would they know that? Unless an elephant had once been to Westeros." Right. So I think that in the same way that, like, Better Call Saul is on occasion sort of dropping little origin stories for Breaking
little
Bad.
Little just-so stories, yeah.
Yeah. I think that that's probably what's happening here, is that George is sort of winking to the people who might pick up on the clue.
Well, I also think there might be a little bit of suggesting that Daenerys' dragons are going to be very, very famous. Like, you should expect big things from these, because these are from the Brood of Dreamfire, which is, again, this large, aggressive, powerful Targaryen dragon. Like, you're supposed to understand that this is from, like, this is like Secretariat's children. Like, you should expect big things from him. Maybe that's the only other thing, besides for him wanting to, you know, garden the hell out of this scenario. It's maybe just, you know, a little bit of more street cred for Daenerys' kids.
I think so.
Like, and their mama was a big famous dragon.
If these three eggs are not the eggs that Dany ends up acquiring, then I don't know what the purpose of them are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, it's possible that this is just something we're making a big deal out of, but it's pretty conspicuous, I think.
Yeah. Then there's another point I liked is that Allison, the Queen Allison, Jaehaerys's sister wife, queen, when she goes, they go on these things called progressions, which is that an actual, like, royal term, like, just to kind of tour the land, or is this a mayhaps kind of thing, a George, a fuddy-duddy George term?
No, processions were really important in the ancient world, especially after a great battle. So if you were going to be part of a royal progression, you are going to parade yourself into the city on the war horses, and you're going to have a litter of, you know, animals that you've acquired, and slaves in chains behind the big procession, and people will come out to meet you and hail you as king. So whenever a king comes to town, sometimes you'll do that so that sort of you're proclaimed from far off, and the small folk can come out and wave their bras at you or whatever. So it is a way to it's a power play. I think it's a way to show the small folk that this is not any normal arrival. This is a special dignitary sort of arrival.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of politics of that too, because they talked about like Aegon used to do these progressions and it would like bankrupt the realm. Like he would go to some lord's house with his 1,000 knights and his 3 dragons and his 2 wives, and they said they would leave the lord with his wine cellars emptied and half the serving girls with great lords bastards in their bellies, you know, like he it was just
like
a real mess.
Van Halen, did you ever hear this?
Yes.
Van Halen would say, "Yep, I'm coming to town. I'm gonna screw your girlfriend,
and make sure there's no green M&Ms in the bowl." But I thought it was also kind of like Jaehaerys was like wise about that. He's like, you know, I'm gonna scale this on back, and also I'm gonna use these as kind of like whistle stop tours, so I can talk directly to the little people and see what their needs are. And he also, you know, like his queen was really progressive. She had these. What is it called? The ladies' court or something, where she would encourage all of the ladies and the small folk women to come to her and tell them her problems. And she's passing a lot of legislation, like
right.
You know, that it's illegal to throw a second wife out of the castle once the lord dies, because a lot of the children are doing that vindictively. And also, mm-hmm. It's illegal to cut the first children of a lord out of the will once he marries a second wife and starts having kids with her. Like, there's a whole bunch of like common sense, like female friendly legislation that she's trying to pass through her husband, which I thought was kind of interesting. Did I already mention this about because the whole reason I want to start with this is that Allison, when they were visiting the Citadel, she spent a lot of her time pestering the maesters, like attending their lectures, demanding open access to the libraries. And, you know, she said, you know, if I wasn't a queen, I might be a bang-up maester. Hey, why don't you let the girls come in and study? And if they're not clever enough, send them home, you know, like you do with all the dumb boys you have. Like, if you recognize that not all men are capable of being a maester, then why not just open it up? And the way that George wrote that is like the maesters kind of like nodded and smiled and said they'd take her advice under consideration and wadded it up and filed it under, you know, file 13.
You know, it's kind of interesting in this sense, because even though the Faith of the Seven is very patriarchal, they've got this sort of big council called the Most Devout.
Mm.
And these are kind of the big power brokers. And it does include the most devout will include septas as well as septons.
Mm.
So it is not unheard of to have sort of these important female leaders in Old Town. But again, this is one of those times when, you know, these are the exceptions and not the rule. In this case, academia is more patriarchal than the church.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that also reminded me of another point about the Jaehaerys's 7, like, what'd you call them? The 7 he sent forth.
The seven speakers.
Yeah. Is that 3 of them were a septon and 2 septas that were sent to Queen Allison specifically to talk her out of marrying her brother. And what happened is they got converted to her because they saw how kind and wise and smart and loving and caring about the small folk. They're like, yeah, we don't see a problem with her marrying her brother. So it's like the opposite. The opposite happened.
So, and that was the same portion of the book where we get sort of our most lurid sidebar.
Oh, right, right, right.
Because in addition to these septas that are sent to convince her not to marry her brother, there's this, oh gosh, what's her name? Do you remember her name?
Corianne Wilde.
Yeah, of course.
Last name, Wilde.
So Miss Wilde is the subject of this probably apocryphal book or legendary book, and it's the subtitle is a cautionary tale for young maidens or something like that.
Yeah, it's a caution for young girls, but it's called like Sins of the Flesh, a Wanton's right. Tale. There's a it's been copied and it's semi pornographic by the time of like you right. know the Baratheon and, period.
Baylor the Blessed famously burned a bunch of these things, but common folk still keep copies in the brothel because there's all these details of this of what Miss Wilde did in her sort of misadventures. So, but the whole reason it's included is that along with these septas that are sent to Dragonstone, there's this Miss Wilde that goes with them, and her job is to seduce Jaharis and to sort of show him the ways of the world, and maybe he will sort of leave his sister behind and maybe be attracted to her or
piss her sister off, his sister off, so she doesn't want him anymore because they catch him or in bed.
She gets pregnant and that creates a complication. Yeah. But of course the maester then after this seven-page excursion.
Yes.
Says, yeah, but these were all rumors, and we shouldn't take them seriously.
And then none of it worked anyway. Like, even if all of it was true, that Jaharis either remained chaste or just, like, you know, had sex with the girl and then still loved his queen. Who cares, you know? Yeah, it's one of those weird... there's a lot of that. That's like I'm saying the gossipy TMZ stuff. Like, there was a passage where Magor took... Because Magor seemed like he was borderline barren or infertile. His swimmers didn't work right. So he took to bed three different queens that were all known to be able to have children, and they were called the Black Brides. And he married them all on the same day. And there's like a page and a half where the maester is like, did they share all a bed? Did he visit them sequentially? Did they have one orgy? Was the Kingsguard involved? Were there goats present? Mayhaps we'll never know. And he just goes like, it's just like, again, a page and a half of him speculating on these nuptial arrangements with Magor and the Black Brides. And it's like, man, George, you really should sell this anonymously on Amazon because there's a market for that smut stuff. And I know you want to do it.
Well, that's exactly it. I think this is George's sort of veiled commentary about you priests at the Catholic Church, you're preaching against this stuff, but we know what you're really interested in. I think that there's kind of some veiled commentary in the repressed sexuality of the Catholic Church in this.
Right. Yeah, no. The more you try to repress those urges, the more they come out in other ways. So
not to say we are all. I mean, look, we're all we're all very carnal creatures. We all have our own little quirks and things we don't like to talk about in public. It's the hypocrisy.
He's about to start preaching LaDon exceptionalism. Watch out.
Hey, I wasn't the one that suggested that it would be okay to marry brothers and sisters, Aaron.
Hey, that's because I'm not trying to repress that urge. You're not going to catch me fucking my sister, Anthony. So, the only other point, and this is kind of like the exclamation point at the end of this section, is that Princess Art, and her name is spelled like Aria, but I think it's going to be pronounced, if I got the Targaryen pronunciation guide, it's going to be pronounced Arya. And she's this very headstrong, willful child of Rhaena Targaryen. And she, when she's like 12 or 13, gets tired of being cooped up, because at this point, it's just her and Rhaena in Dragonstone, because Rhaena's pissed off her husband and he's poisoned all of her attendants. And then her one lover ran off with her dragon eggs. And Arya is just cooped up here, and she impetuously steals Balerion the Black Dread, Not any of the hatchlings that were on offer. She went to the biggest, like Balerion at this point is ancient and old. He's like nearing 300 years old. And they mentioned that like he sleeps most of the time, but he's also this huge mythical thing. When you rouse him, he's still terrifying to behold. And this 13-year-old girl jumps on his back and disappears. And that's kind of like where we're heading into the next section, which I thought is interesting. Because like, you know, it sounds very much like our Arya, you know?
Yeah, it says that she's never ridden a dragon before, so she's good with horses, but she gets pissed off and she just wants to, she just wants to storm out, and yeah. she mounts Balerion and she hasn't seen for years and years, and we won't spoil the next section, but I will say this, that what happens to her is pretty crazy and pretty interesting, and probably one of the most interesting passages of this book that I've read so far.
Mm-hmm. That's anything else we want to say, or should we move on to feedback?
Let's go to the feedback.
Okay, feedback. You can send it into gameofthrones@baldmove.com. There's also forum threads for these Gods of Thrones bonus podcasts. First up, Janine S. says, many, many people send us corrections on this. I'm going to read the two most the first one and then the funniest one. It says, okay, I'm listening to the audible version of Fire and Blood, and it pronounces the unfortunate first son of Aegon Aenys, not Anus. It says, yours is hella funnier, but the poor guy has had enough trouble out there. Obviously. Says, also so glad Anthony and I had the same idea about the initial section of pre-conquest Targaryen history, just pretty much straight copied from World of Ice and Fire. I started to give up at that point, but decided to read on and see if it indeed was a cut-and-paste job. Happily, it doesn't appear to be so. The thing I'm noticing about the book is that it's giving some personality to the Targaryens, who I don't really much like in the series. It's also given us some big clues into the Baratheon ties without boring us to death and getting us lost in all the YS names. Speaking of, I do want a better description of the dragons. Gurm needs to put out a definitive pronunciation guide. For example, like we know King Aerys is pronounced Aerys, but then you have the A-R-Y-S. Is that Aerys? That's one of my big complaints too, Janine, because I'm pretty terrible at pronunciation anyway, and a lot of these names just look like way too many vowels and way too many Ys. And they all kind of run together.
Well, all right, let's put it this way. If your name was Anus, wouldn't you tell everyone it's pronounced Anise?
Yeah, put an umlaut over that whatever YS thing, you and, know? Like, yeah. Do something. Diacletic mark or whatever they're called.
Yeah, we'd put an umlaut. I think that we need a lot more umlauts in Targaryen names. That'll help.
Otherwise, you just got a bigoth dicketh situation, and it's not good. moving on, Mark says, your conversation on the pod about Anus was cracking me up. My wife is Egyptian, and her father, who is actually from Egypt, has the middle name of A-N-I-S, pronounced like you did at one point, Anise. His culture dictated that my wife and her siblings all have that middle name as well, and she hates it. She would tell stories about every substitute teacher ever reading the wrong name column and asking if Anus was present. Oh, man. I can relate, because my real last name is very German, and it rhymes with jerk off. And right around the fourth or fifth grade, every boy in my class's eyes lit up, and forevermore, I was a jerk off. So
okay, I never really had a problem with
it's
this,
actually Jerk but... Jerky off. To by the way, if it's the correct German pronunciation,
I never really had a problem with this because you wouldn't know it unless you know Italian. But my last name is Ladon, which is Italian for the women. It's women plural.
Huh.
And so yeah, so it's not the most, you know,
masculine.
No, as a kid growing up, you know, you're struggling to figure out what it means to be masculine.
Sure,
it's not. It doesn't really help if
you call Anthony the woman or the women.
Yeah, yeah. It's
you can take it as You could take it as descriptive, or you could also take it as like your legend, like, you know, your Anthony of the women, the notches on his belt. There's, he had to have three belts because there just weren't enough notches.
No. It was. I'm sure of it. I visited the village where the Ladons come from. Uh-huh. I'm sure that it's just all of these really strong women who have sort of defined the family, and as it so happens, that is the case with my family too. But yeah, not as bad as jerk off
or anus
or
anus. Pour one out for all the anuses present. Michael S., I've been really enjoying your podcast on religions, the Game of Thrones, and review of Fire and Blood. Well, thank you, Michael. I can't help but read this book and envision an HBO dark comedy about Maegor Targaryen. Basically, he just murders everyone who disagrees with him and makes fun of him, and everyone makes fun of him behind his back. What do you think? Yeah, there's a lot of, in Maegor's chapters, a lot of, like, dark humor that's very similar to, like, Metalocalypse. If you ever watched that, the Cartoon Network Adult Swim series, where it's just, everything is brutal and metal, and it's just like, again, this guy spent 6 months executing and torturing, you know, people that betrayed him, and he is a tragically comic fellow if he wasn't so much of a bastard.
Well, let me ask you this. So we've read a third of the book, and we know that HBO is going to do these prequel series.
Mm-hmm.
Which character in the book so far is intriguing enough to you that you would actually like to see a spinoff series?
Honestly, early on, like, I'm really digging Jaehaerys. Like, he is by far the biggest heroic figure. He has the most internal dialogue. He has the most actual dialogue. He seems like a good leader by almost modern day. Like, Aegon, it's so funny how Aegon was treated as, like, an arm's length removed by this maester. Like, you know, he's this elemental force, and he's, you know, just and wise and handsome and a fierce warrior and brooding and... But he's kind of like Batman, you know? It's hard to kind of get a handle on him. Whereas Jaehaerys, I found very... I mean, he's very clever. He's like, you know, Aegon with the mind of a Tyrion.
Right.
He's very clever and funny.
You know what I think would work? Because there's just so much about Old Town we don't know about from the novels and from the series. If you wanted to do a series about, like, I don't know, something about the maesters in Old Town.
Yeah.
And sort of these maesters navigating these new Targaryens in Westeros or something, you wouldn't have to rigidly follow any sort of narrative that George has come up with, because you would have a little bit more freedom on discussing the politics of Old Town as compared to the politics of King's Landing at this point.
Yeah. I also thought it'd be, when you said that, like, a sillier version of that would be, like, re-envisioning the maesters as, like, this, like, Kingsman secret order, you know? That they're actually, like, they're the 006s of the kingdom, and they're poisoning people that need to be poisoned, they're murdering dragons, and maybe, like, I was thinking, oh, maybe the Faceless Men is their equivalent in Braavos. Like, you know, they're really the power behind the power, but they're just less showy about how they flex it. I thought that would be kind of cool.
So I saw that Naomi Watts has been cast for one of the prequels.
Yeah, she's like the principal, yeah.
It's an interesting sort of, and I haven't heard of any other names, have you?
Uh-uh, no. And I don't even really know what she, I mean, I like Naomi Watts. I think she's a really incredible actor. One of my favorite movies of all time is I Heart Huckabees, and she's just wonderful in that movie. So, like, I'm intrigued. I don't know what they're gonna do with her. Like, I kind of like, I just because of where she is in her her life, like, I kind of want to cast her in, like, a Cersei role, you know?
Maybe
a fading beauty that's, like, cunning or has a lot of leadership. Maybe she's, like, the anti-Cersei in that way. But I have no idea. But it's kind of cool.
Well, you wouldn't cast her and have her be the first major announcement unless she's going to be in some key role, right?
No, she's like, honestly, like, that's like, this is very similar to like Sean Bean being announced. Like, he was the anchor of the first season. Of course, you know, we all know what happened to the poor Sean.
Right.
But yeah, no, I'm excited to see what ends up happening with that. All right, last one. Danny wanted to touch on some feedback of last week on the at the end of the podcast. The heathenist, Russell, says, I'm a religious teacher myself, and I'm a pious, or is it pious or pious, Anthony?
Pious.
Pious, okay. I'm a religious leader myself, and I'm a pious man, but believe it or not, I still love pop culture, and I take great joy with both of those things in my life. I think the gentleman's feedback last week hit the nail on the head. Belief should not be a two-dimensional topic, non-believers and believers, but rather viewed as in the widest lens possible. I like to look at it as such. Believers seek answers and guidance that will give them a higher purpose in order to then seek a solution to the reality that then pushes them into actions, where non-believers, on the other hand, are content in their reality. They're happy with the understanding that they already have. Both are fantastic if one feels happy and that they belong, which is why I think Russell's feedback is great, because it demonstrates that no matter where you are or who you are, religion, no religion, different religions, it's all shapes of our world. Your podcast and your book doesn't just hit the nail on the head with this, but smashes it through the plank and out the other side. So I say thank you for that. It's also good to see educated and quality feedback. It speaks volumes of the type of podcast you have going there. High praise. High praise, Danny. For the record, heathenry is a new religious movement, also known as Asatru or Odinism. It follows the belief generally in the gods of the Norse pantheon, very community-based with a strong focus on family and honoring your ancestors and spirits done so through blots. They have strong ideals on fate. Some groups are more radical than others, but it's generally a very interesting and noble practice. United States military just included it on its list for religious identification. That's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, I remember my old co-host, Mad Brew, we got in a talk about religion in the military, because when he was going through the Marines, he was an atheist, and the United States military actually has a separate icon for atheist religious affiliation, and you can actually get that. It's like a little A with an atomic symbol around it. You can have that put on your cross at Arlington if you want. But he talked about how much pressure he had from the chaplain to put anything other than atheist. And he had to kind of like, he had to kind of like buck the chain of command to stand by his principle there. I will say that as a representative non-believer, I don't say that I'm content in my understanding. I'm not. I mean, I definitely want to understand more, and I'm always like seeking for different meanings. I guess it's more of like, I feel like my accurate description of my emotional state is I'm content with the uncertainty.
That's really interesting, and I think that we may be foreshadowing our religion discussion, because I think that uncertainty is kind of what keeps me within the fold of Christianity. So you and I have a lot of similarities, even though we've landed in different spots.
Yeah, it's just I'm staunchly no sister fucking, and I can tell there's a little wiggle there with you. There's a little flex. There's a little flex we're going to have to talk about, Anthony.
I see how you spun this on me. But you are on the record, sir. Should I have the court reporter read back the transcript?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll let that be an exercise for the listeners. That is the feedback we have for this week. And if you want to send us more, you can do so at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can also get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. We have a Game of Thrones section there. And we have the thread for each of these little bonus podcasts we're doing for Gods of Thrones and Fire and Blood. All right, next week we're going to be considering from Jaehaerys and Alysanne, their triumphs and tragedies, all the way to the dying of the dragons, Rhaenyra Triumphant. If you'd like to participate in that, do so through the feedback we just talked about. If you've enjoyed this discussion of Game of Thrones by Anthony and I, please go out and buy our book. I think you'll really like it. It makes a great Christmas present. It's now on sale courtesy of Amazon. You can find a link to the paperback and the electronic version in the show notes that is on your podcast player right now, or on the associated article at baldmove.com. Otherwise, we will see you again next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
I'll see you later.